My name is Paul Weber, and on behalf of my colleague, Dr. Syed Sattar of the University of Ottawa, welcome to the teleclass, Controlling MRSA and VRE, Is It Important to Identify the Reservoir? Of the several thousand of us on this call today, almost 1,000 are participating for the first time, and I want to offer you guys a special welcome. Our presenter today is a great guy, and I've always thoroughly enjoyed our talks together. Dr. Barry Farr is hospital epidemiologist and professor of medicine and epidemiology at the University of Virginia Health System. He's very well respected in his field and has just completed a term as president of SHEA. I'm not going to say a whole lot more about him or about the process. We'll try to leave some time for questions after the formal presentation, but there's a lot of stuff to cover, so to present, Controlling MRSA and VRE, Is It Important to Identify the Reservoir? I give you Dr. Barry Farr.
Thank you very much, Paul, and greetings to the group. I would ask that you go to the first slide that says infectious disease process, and I'll just start by saying this is a CDC slide that I borrowed, and it comes from Epidemiology 101, which just recognizes that for pretty much every infection, there is an etiologic agent. It has somewhere that it lives, a reservoir, from which it spreads to others. And we're going to be talking about whether it is important to identify the reservoir for MRSA and VRE in order to control infections. For most infectious processes, this, I believe, is obvious, that if you're having an outbreak of Legionella, you need to know where it's coming from, and you need to do something about that reservoir. And I will proceed with that premise. Next slide. I put this one up from Hill's book on medical statistics, in which he proposed criteria for causal inference in epidemiologic studies. And probably many of the people on this call are aware of this and have read his work. But he talks about things about the strength of association, consistency of evidence across studies, the temporal relationship, biological gradient, reversibility, specificity. You may hear me refer to some of those things in passing, and during our time for questions, you can ask more. Let's go on to the next slide, which shows a rapid increase in penicillin-resistant Staph aureus in the Hammersmith Hospital in London back in the 1940s. You can see 1941 listed there, and it says less than 1% because early surveys of Staph aureus showed virtually none were resistant to what then was viewed almost as a panacea, because the first human being who ever was treated with penicillin showed a dramatic response before they ran out of the drug, and then he relapsed and died in Oxford, England in 1941. And then the drug began to be implemented, as you can see, in the 1940s. And just within a three-year period, resistance rates to it soared. No one knew exactly why that was happening at the time. If you go to the next slide, you can see a graph that was compiled, put together from a variety of sources by Dr. Chip Chambers from San Francisco, and appears in an emerging infections issue a couple of years ago, and shows that it occurred first and foremost inside healthcare systems, and then later out in the community it showed up. Next slide. Which just lists mechanisms of developing antibiotic resistance. And I'll just note that there are many, and that none of these explain the exponential increase that we just looked at in the previous graph. Let's go on to the next slide, which shows you probably the oldest reference I'll show, which is from 1859. Charles Darwin said that in every environment there is a struggle to survive, and nature selects the strain or species best suited to survive within a particular environment. Next slide. Which shows that the prevalence of antibiotic therapy in modern hospitals in our country is very high, almost half in some surveys, and virtually all patients in ICUs. With such a very high prevalence of patients being on antibiotics, it doesn't take Albert Einstein to imagine that a strain with a mutation for resistance is going to enjoy a selective advantage to survive, to proliferate, and to spread. Next slide. This is just an example. It says univariate analysis of antibiotic exposure. It just shows cases who ended up with VRE and controls who did not, and all the different the prevalences of antibiotics that these people were on a high-risk ward, which shows that we're using lots of antibiotics. Next slide. You can see in this one, which is titled VRE Incidents, that one ICU in its step-down unit had no cases of VRE, while VRE was epidemic in two other ICUs and their step-down units as close as one floor away. And that's despite doing cultures just as frequently in all of the ICUs and the other units. And many people look at that and they assume that the reason for this must be having heard about this high prevalence of antibiotics and that that is an important predictor, that the antibiotics must be more out of control on the third and fifth floor. Next slide shows a pulse-filled gel electrophoresis pattern, which shows that there were two different strains of VRE spreading in this outbreak, and they were spreading patient to patient to patient, and that is what explains the lack of VRE on the sixth floor, that the VRE hadn't arrived there yet. Next slide. This shows a list of previous studies to that one showing transmission of individual clones of VRE. And we've really seen microbes spread within healthcare facilities over and over and over again. It doesn't matter what the bug is. You can see pretty much anything spread, even malaria, inside of a hospital. And we've done it with increasing technological sophistication over time, such as with pulse-filled gel electrophoresis, as we saw in the previous slide. But VRE has been shown over and over, as have many other microbes. Next slide. I told you that the previous slide was my oldest reference. This is my oldest symbol. This is the symbol of yin and yang from ancient Chinese philosophy. And the dark symbol, yin, is said to be receptive. And I have likened, because yin is always used first, to the use of antibiotics in this causation of antibiotic resistance. The lighter one, which is yang, is said to be masculine and penetrating, and I have therefore, and because it always comes after yin, likened it to spread. And I think that these two factors go together to explain most of what we see in the epidemiology of antibiotic-resistant infections, that there is the use of the drugs, which is important as a risk factor, and then there is spread. Next slide. Now we're looking at a graph from the NIST program from hospitals throughout the United States showing MRSA infection rates going higher and higher. They've essentially doubled during the decade that's displayed in this graph. At the end of that decade, accounting for almost half of all of the Staph aureus infections in those hospitals, they have since gone even higher. Next slide. When MRSA arrived in my hospital, as shown in this slide that's titled Failure to Prevent MRSA Spread, it arrived in 78. Before that, there was none, as you can see. And in 79, there was more than in 78. In 80, there was still more. And by 80, almost half of the bloodstream and surgical site infections due to Staph aureus were all due to the same strain of MRSA. This was despite the fact that when they were known from clinical cultures, they were being put in isolation. And many people would look at this and say, well, there you have it. You know, there's no point going to all the trouble. You might as well cut your losses and not bother with isolation. But they were only putting the people in isolation that they knew about from ClinMicro. Let's go to the next slide. This shows when they started looking beyond what ClinMicro provided by going out and doing active surveillance cultures to look for the pathogen. And they found that it had spread to a bunch of people that were asymptomatically colonized. They had no idea they had it. And when they put them into isolation, you can see that the whole outbreak began to be controlled. The prevalence, the incidence, the infections, everything was controlled. Next slide. And what had been out of control, spreading and killing patients for 2.5 years, was then completely eradicated from the hospital within 1.5 years. And that was done just so we understand the importance of yang and of controlling yang. This was done with no antibiotic control effort of any kind, because many people feel that yin is where you've got to exert your control. And although I've made the point that yin is important, this is showing the importance of yang and of controlling yang. Next slide. And so this brings us to an iceberg slide, which is the reservoir for spread of antibiotic-resistant infections. And the point here is that the patients that are recognized by the results of Klin microcultures, as in the previous study that I just showed you, represent the tip of a figurative iceberg. And all those other patients that are colonized and are asymptomatic that you don't know about unless you look with surveillance cultures are far more important in the ongoing evolution of the epidemic than are the ones that you know about from Klin microcultures. Next slide. The CDC guidelines on isolation precautions have since 1983 said that patients with epidemiologically important pathogens that are antibiotic resistance that spread through contact or indirect contact should be cared for using special precautions, wearing gowns and gloves, so that when we go into the room, we don't pick up those organisms and carry them into the rooms of the next patient that we go to see. And I highlighted on this slide that they emphasize the word colonized here. Despite that, most hospitals have looked at that and they assume that if they're colonized and they find out about it from Klin Micro, then they'll deal with it and they'll put them in isolation. But I've just shown you data that suggests that a large majority of the people that are colonized will not be recognized with that approach. Next slide. This is just another example of using active surveillance cultures and controlling an outbreak in a place where MRSA can spread and spread explosively, which is in a neonatal intensive care unit. Go to the next slide, which talks about follow-up after control of that outbreak. And you can see that over the next decade after that outbreak was controlled, in 100,000 patient days in a unit with a high frequency of antibiotic therapy, there were no MRSA cases, which means MRSA doesn't just pop up on its own. Virtually every patient that has it because it was spread from another patient. Next slide. This is just an example of this approach being used to control two outbreaks in a neonatal intensive care unit in Cincinnati, Ohio, and shows that it worked quite well. I will note that you can see there that 5 of the outpatients, 16% in the first outbreak, became infected. 1 died of MRSA bloodstream infection. In the second outbreak, although it worked quite well, 4 became infected, 29%, and another died of MRSA bloodstream infection. So these infections have a cost. Let's go to the next slide, which shows a list of studies reporting control of MRSA using active surveillance cultures and contact precautions. Now let's go on to the next slide, which looks just like the last one that we saw. And the reason is there's a lot of studies shown that this works. I want you to remember back to Hill's criteria for causality in epidemiologic studies, in which he talked about consistency of evidence. Usually when people talk about consistency of evidence, they're talking about a few studies. We're talking about scores of studies. Next slide. Here are several studies from Northern European countries that show an exceedingly low prevalence using this approach. Next slide. And this is a graph from Denmark that showed that MRSA actually got up to 1/3 of all of the Staph aureus infections in Danish hospitals before they began to try to control it. And then they did control it over a number of years. And then you can see there for a lot of years, and if you speak to the people in the health department in Denmark, it's still less than 1%. So they have for 25 years, using a proactive approach, controlled this pathogen. Look at that graph one more second. Notice that penicillin-resistant staph was never controlled. This is showing specificity of the approach that we're talking about. Only MRSA is being controlled. It's the only one they're doing surveillance cultures for and putting into contact precautions. PRSA, they never did and they never controlled it, and it's just as out of control there as it is here. Same thing for methicillin-resistant staph epi and other coagulative staph. Next slide, and it shows a stacking of four different graphs. This is from a paper that was in the Journal of Infectious Diseases in 95. The background is black, the text is in white. And you can see, if you look at the top graph, that's showing the colonization rate with MRSA, and it's averaging about half of all of the babies in the neonatal intensive care unit over a period of about 51 months. If you look at the very bottom graph, that's showing spikes every time there is a MRSA infection. Over a four-year period, they had 75 bloodstream infections due to the outbreak strain of MRSA in that neonatal intensive care unit. What this is pointing out to us is that if we choose to look the other way and let this go, it will go. And 14 of the babies in that outbreak died with MRSA sepsis. Next slide. Well, that's MRSA. Now let's talk a little bit about VRE. And I realize there's some of you from Europe, and there's a slightly different story in Europe, or has been, but VRE is starting to show up, or strains with a special virulence factor, the ESP gene, are showing up in Europe now, like they've been present in this country, that are starting to cause outbreaks in clinical settings like we have seen. But this is just showing the graph in U.S. hospitals, again, from the NIST program. And you can see that this exploded over that same decade that I showed you MRSA doubling. This went from virtually undetectable to almost a quarter of all enterococcal infections in the NIST hospitals. Next slide. This shows you that it doesn't have to keep going higher and higher. This is from my hospital. It was published in ICHI a couple of years ago. And it shows the red are showing you clinical infections, some of them severe. The very first patient was bacteremic and died of VRE bacteremia, so it got our attention in a big hurry. You can see that the red kept getting higher and higher until we implemented active surveillance cultures. The CDC had issued its recommendations for controlling vancomycin resistance at that point only in the Federal Register. It had not been published other than that. But we looked at the Federal Register, and it said for more efficient containment, use active surveillance cultures, so we did. And you can see that all the green are those that we detected just by doing the active surveillance culture. So the vast majority are detected only by looking for it. And this is showing that same iceberg phenomenon we looked at with MRSA, and it's also showing the same control that we saw with MRSA. As you begin to control colonization, because that's how this spreads, it's an epidemic of colonization. If you ignore the colonization, you will not control the infections with this. So as you control the colonizations, the infections disappear. Next slide. And I'll just note that in one of the ICUs, this says VRE in one of the ICUs reached 100% early in that outbreak. And I say this because some hospitals say, well, you know, we've got 40%. We can't bother. You know, there's a lot of this. Well, that ICU started with 100%, and it was converted to 0% using this approach. And then we kept it at 0% over an entire year, showing that even though we had no antibiotic control program in the hospital, that it was possible to control this. We did, I will mention, even though we didn't have a formal antibiotic control program, limit vancomycin usage, which cut it in half. But I will also note that vanco was not a risk factor for VRE in our outbreak, as it has been true in a number of recent publications. Next slide. And some people think that if you give a patient enough antibiotics, you'll just turn their own enterococcus into VRE. And that's clearly not true. If you speak to a microbiologist and say that, they will laugh in your face. This is Barbara Murray in the New England Journal saying antibiotics alone will not select for VRE if resistant bacteria are not already present or if a patient does not come into contact with them. And just making the point, the way patients get this is by spread. Next slide. This is just showing the results in a California tertiary care hospital, where you can see the VRE hospital-wide infection rate going along on the left, and then you can see an arrow showing where they started doing active surveillance cultures and contact precautions for all the patients they found, and you can see that they controlled it quite well over the next year. Next slide. Here are data from a New York hospital that reported data on both cost effectiveness and control, and they were able to control a VRE outbreak that was very high prevalence and very polyclonal. Some people think that it's very high prevalence, or if it's polyclonal, then you can't control it. And this is just showing that both of those assumptions are wrong, and they controlled it, and it was very cost effective. Next slide. This shows a very colorful graph from the University of Pittsburgh. The name at the bottom is MUTO. It's from IDSA 2001. And it shows the red figure going higher and higher. That is compliant with doing surveillance cultures. And you can see as they approach 100% compliance, the prevalence of VRE, which is shown in yellow, is going down over the same period and going down significantly. And that was also in a hospital with a high prevalence and polyclonality, showing that that can be done despite that. Now, the next slide that we are coming to says Ostrowski at the bottom. And it's VRE prevalence in hospitals and nursing homes throughout an entire health district, where the same approach that we just saw at the University of Pittsburgh is being implemented. They're doing active surveillance cultures in all facilities, and they're placing patients that have it into contact precautions. And what this did was it either eliminated it or significantly reduced it in all facilities throughout that entire health district, which is remarkable. It was published in the New England Journal. The CDC published a press release that went at the same time this came out and said that this was a role model for all health regions. And I would ask all those listening whether your region has begun to start to do this. Next slide. This shows data. You can see data from my hospital, which is labeled UVA at the far right. These are VRE and MRSA bloodstream infections in hospitals of comparable size and complexity over the calendar year 1999. They're all university hospitals. And you can see some of them have a lot more MRSA. And I'll just remind you that UVA, back in the year 1980, remember that year when almost half of all of our bloodstream infections were MRSA? Well, that's where the average NIST hospital is getting today. And I'll just point out, UVA was way ahead of the curve. We were leading the nation in MRSA two decades ago. And I just wanted to point out, we could still be doing that. This is not because we have a sleepy community with very mildly ill patients. If you read that article in ICHI, you'll see that we cite data from an independent group that note that UVA's patients are one of the top one or two hospitals in the state of 7 million people in terms of complexity and acuity of illness. So we have the sickest patients in the state. And despite that, we have one of the lowest rates of antibiotic-resistant infections during 1999, causing serious bloodstream infections, which we'll talk about in a moment what that can lead to. I will point out that this difference in the numbers can lead to very large differences in the excess costs, because published studies have concluded that these antibiotic-resistant infections cost more. And if you multiply the difference between the UVA rates and these other university hospitals, then that comes to between $1 and $3 million extra dollars lost for those other hospitals each year. I'll also note that hospitals E and F, you see no MRSA, and that's not because there is no MRSA in those hospitals. It's because they were not doing surveillance and they had no idea what their MRSA rates were. Let's go on to the next slide. And just like for the MRSA, I'm going to show you that there are quite a few studies that have reported that active surveillance cultures and contact precautions work to control VRE infections. Now let's go to the next slide, which looks a lot like the previous slide, and it's just that there are lots and lots of these studies. I've been told that at the SHEA meeting in a month, you're going to see more. Next slide. Now, having shown you lots and lots and lots of studies that show that this works. There are a few studies that suggest that it doesn't. And I'm going to point out to you that these studies tend to have done this with very small samples of their hospital, like one ward in one hospital, two in another one, where, you know, if you're doing this on a small fraction, you're again focusing on that small tip of the iceberg. And if you're going to ignore all the rest of the iceberg, you're not going to control this. Next slide. We're now looking at a slide where the name Kim is at the bottom. It's from JID in 1999. And the question is, what about the hospital with high prevalence and polyclonality? Some people have said that can't be spreading in there because it's all these different strains when you look at the pulse field. But this very careful study concluded using molecular epidemiology that early on in their experience with VRE, it was very few clones, and they were spreading. And as they went forward in time, more arrived, and they started spreading. And so that appears to explain you accumulate extra strains that arrive there from elsewhere. Next slide. This one is from Bonten et al. It's actually from the same hospital as Kim. And they looked very carefully at an ICU, and they concluded that colonization pressure was the most important predictor of new patients who came to an ICU acquiring it. And so being on antibiotics is important, certainly. I would never disagree with that. But the most important factor, according to this analysis, was how many other people had it. If everybody else had VRE and you get admitted or your mother gets admitted, guess who's going to be next? Next slide. And this study from De Lancastre et al. From the Rockefeller showed that in an outbreak of VRE in New York City, transposons that can flick from enterococcus to enterococcus explained virtually all of the polyclonality in the outbreak. And again, this is despite patient-to-patient spread. So the point is you can't use pulse fill in order to figure out whether you're having spread or not in these outbreaks sometimes. Next slide. All right, now you should be looking at a slide that says at the top, could hand hygiene alone control MRSA like this? And my answer will be no, because remember at the top I showed you, pointed out that penicillin resistant staph aureus was going merrily along, and there are no data that could be controlled with hand hygiene alone, and there are no data that MRSA could be controlled like that alone. Because, as I said, those countries in Northern Europe like Denmark, the Netherlands, Finland, other Scandinavian countries, they're doing active surveillance cultures and putting people into contact precautions. Next slide. Now, let's look at some data about hand hygiene, because some people say, well, hand hygiene, there's your thing. What if everybody did it right? Wouldn't that solve everything? And I'm all for that. I believe in doing it right, and my hospital was way ahead of most hospitals in this country in going to alcohol, not as far along as Europe, which was mostly using alcohol everywhere for quite a few years. So I'm all for it, but I also like to look at the data. So let's look at these data. In the United States, in 1987, the CDC recommended universal precautions, which had a huge emphasis upon hand hygiene, and that you had to have facilities for hand hygiene and so forth in the areas where there was clinical care, and that people had to be educated about hand hygiene, among other things, and that you had to not only orient them to that before they ever cared for a patient in your hospital, but you had to reorient them by retraining them every year, which was a huge increase in the amount of education about infection control measures in U.S. healthcare facilities. It was required by federal regulation. And then in 1996, you can see standard is there after universal, and we changed the name. Not a lot changed between universal and standard, but there is one thing regarding hand hygiene, which was to say that we began to say before and after care of every patient, between care of any two patients, you have to do hand hygiene according to standard precautions. It just became very explicit. It was implicit perhaps before, but it became explicit. Having said that, hand hygiene rates really haven't changed in the studies that have been done over all those years that universal and standard precautions were in effect. And in fact, one recent study in a hospital in the upper Midwest, they built a new hospital, put in more facilities for washing the hands, and expected to see a healthy increase, and came to the National Infectious Disease Meeting and reported that their hand hygiene rates in the new facility had sunk down into the single-digit range. The second number there, which is showing, talking about Pitet's study, which reported a decrease in MRSA as and of nosocomial infections in general as hand hygiene increase, which was in Lancet 2000, has led many to believe, okay, there you have it, hand hygiene will do it. But the same hospital reported, the same authors reported in another journal, the Journal of Hospital Infection, another British journal, just a month later, that they had, over the same years as the hand hygiene campaign, had another major campaign going on, which was doing active surveillance cultures and contact precautions. And they reported the same decrease in MRSA was significantly related to that. And so you can't really talk about the one without looking at the other. And both may have had an impact, but it's impossible to know how much of the MRSA decrease was due to the hand hygiene because of the simultaneous implementation of the other change. And then the third bullet down there is regarding Larson's study, in which she reported a large decrease in VRE, but in their control hospital, where they made no changes, there was a 44% drop, which was not statistically significant, suggesting that there might have been some sort of number, small number problems in these two small hospitals. And there was no significant change in MRSA in the intervention hospital, despite a whopping increase in hand hygiene. Their increase in hand hygiene was so whopping that it meant that there was no way they could have started off with a good hand hygiene rate. It meant they had to have started off at very low rates. And you could start off at a very low rate and get a whopping increase and still have only a minority of people doing hand hygiene. And we don't know, because they didn't do the study so that you could see what was the actual rate of hand hygiene, given that they had touched the patient or the environment in the patient's room. It wasn't done that way. They had counters in soap dispensers, and they measured counts. So you can't really answer some of the questions you'd like to. Next slide. This again is focusing on hand hygiene and whether it and standard precautions can control these things alone. And you can see the top two there, which are Austin, a study by Austin in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science, and another one by Sabille from France, which is in ICHI. Those are two mathematical models. The top one is about VRE. The next one is about MRSA. And they're looking at the ICU environment, and they both conclude that even with whopping increases in hand hygiene alone, that you will get only a modest reduction in either VRE or in MRSA. The first one concluded that better control was found with active surveillance cultures and cohort isolation. The second one ended by recommending active surveillance cultures and contact precautions. The next item down there, which is number six, talks about the fact that some people have reported that a couple of MRSA NICU outbreaks were controlled when the hospital switched from chlorhexidine to triclosan, and they said, well, that must mean that hand hygiene is what did it. But I just want to point out, just like that old saying about the straw that broke the camel's back, this was one thing that was added to many other control measures that were already in place, and they didn't cancel all those other measures. In fact, they explicitly said they kept doing all of those things, which in one, they were using weekly active surveillance cultures, presumably to do something different with those that were positive, and in the other, they were using gowns, gloves, cohorting, and they were bathing every neonate with triclosan, trying to reduce colonization. Let's go on to the next slide. And you'll see three more studies here that have talked about hand hygiene And so we're still trying to decide whether there is enough data to show this could be done, MRSA and VRE could be controlled with this alone. Vernon reported decreases in MRSA and VRE in a long-term care facility using a hand hygiene campaign, but the same authors in a different meeting reported that they had had the hand hygiene campaign in several facilities, and they didn't report success in the other ones, so it's not clear what that meant. Gunlapalli, you see there, reported that VRE increased, but not significantly, after they had done active surveillance cultures and contact precautions for some months, and then they switched to trying very aggressive hand hygiene. So it went up, not significantly. I don't know if they looked long enough, and the abstract did not comment on the control measures going on throughout the rest of the tertiary care hospital, but I don't believe the same measures were being used. And so when you implement things only in one ICU, you're not going to get the same kind of control that I showed you earlier, where you can go from 100% to zero and keep it there. And then Schultz reported at a meeting this past year that VRE declined, but no change in MRSA or C. difficile after the first year of a hand hygiene campaign, which emphasized the use of an alcohol hand rub. Then they said that during the first part of the next year, it came down even more and implied that that would result, if it kept going like that, in a significant reduction. But I'll just wait till I see the rest of that year. Let's go on to the next slide. This one also gets at whether hand hygiene alone will do this. And it comes from a study here at the University of Virginia, which found that when patients were unisolated, there was a higher rate of spread. You can see the rate there. And you can see the rate from patients that were isolated. And we took those rates and we divided. It's been said that by Alex Langmuir that the defining characteristic of an epidemiologist is long division. And you come up with a relative risk of almost 16, which is higher than the relative risk of lung cancer among people who actively smoke. So this is in epidemiologic terms of large strength of association, and I'll remind you that Hill talked about this being one of his criteria for causality in epidemiologic studies. When we know who has it and we use contact precautions, we significantly reduce spread as compared with standard precautions, which is the question that we're looking at right now. Let's go to the next slide. This is Vreens, it says at the bottom. And it's rates of clonal MRSA transmission, and it's looking, if you look at the top again, you have lots of them, 38 with the patients not detected and is unisolated, and only one spread to another individual when the patient was in isolation. If you assume a relatively equivalent population at risk, you can do calculations, and you'll come up with a relative risk of 38 and a very low p-value, as you can see there. I want to just emphasize that Vreens article is in the Netherlands, where they are credited as being one of the very best at doing antibiotic control, and some would say they do very good hand hygiene. And the point here is, even if you do other things very well and you don't detect and isolate using this approach, you're going to have lots of spread, and that's what their conclusion was. Let's go on to this next slide, which is Byers conditional logistic regression, and this is showing that with VRE spread in an outbreak, and this is clonal VRE spread, so we know it's all the same, being nearby when another patient was unisolated in the preceding week was the most important risk factor that a patient would come down with this same strain of VRE. And you need to understand that the patients who were in isolation and nearby were not a risk in this analysis. So this is showing in another way that identifying and controlling the spread with these precautions work. Next slide. This is looking at an ecological level, looking sort of macroscopically. We see when universal precautions was implemented and when standard precautions were implemented. And you can see there's no real change in the upward slope of MRSA, next slide, or of VRE. And so I would have to conclude there's very little evidence that we can count on those things to stop this from continuing and or getting worse. Next slide. And one reason that they may get worse when we don't have them in isolation is John Boyce, in this study about isolation gowns, showed that the gowns work. They protect our clothes, keep them from getting contaminated. The gowns get contaminated, but the clothes underneath do not. If we wear a white coat into the room, two-thirds of the time, you can see, they're getting contaminated. And if you touch the contaminated white coat, 3 out of 11 developed positive hand cultures with these antibiotic-resistant bugs. Next slide. And you can see that it's not just Boyce. Here's Zachary from Mass General confirming this. And this was later published in Itchy. Let's see, September of 01 that was published. And you can see that two-thirds of the time after examining a VRE patient, they had VRE contamination on their gown, gloves, and or stethoscopes. And they also noted that the same rate of contamination was found whether the patient was infected with VRE or merely colonized with VRE, making the point, again, you've got to deal with the colonization. It's not just the infections. Next slide. And if I have not driven this point in enough, here's a study that just concluded in the past year from published in Itchy by Srinivasan that wearing gowns was important, and that the spread of VRE went down significantly when gown and gloves were used as compared to gloves alone. Next slide. Same conclusion from a different hospital. This one is WashU. The other one was Johns Hopkins. Same basic conclusion. Next slide. Environmental contamination, it can be fairly frequent, and you can see in one study, 42% of the time when nurses touched surfaces in the room and didn't even touch the patient, their gloves were contaminated with MRSA. Stethoscopes are frequently contaminated. Wiping them with isopropyl alcohol works and has been recommended. Next slide. After a VRE patient dies or is discharged, frequently there is still VRE on a lot of the surfaces in the room. And after the room is disinfected, if you use an old approach, which was a light spray and a Jiffy wipe in our hospital, 16% of the surfaces were still contaminated. The bucket method just meant they were using a more vigorous method of wetting the surfaces, and that always worked. Next slide. Excess cost. These antibiotic-resistant infections are more costly, as you can see. This is MRSA more than MSSA. This is just one, next slide, Abramson study showing that MRSA bloodstream infection was about $17,000 more than an MSSA bloodstream infection. Next slide. Here is a meta-analysis from Cosgrove from Harvard concluding that even after adjusting for severity of illness, MRSA still is more significantly more deadly, about doubling the risk of dying. Next slide. And here it is, a study with pneumonia, much significantly higher rate of death. Next slide, another study with pneumonia, and use of vancomycin was associated with a higher rate of death, whether the patient had MRSA or MSSA in this study. And if you allow MRSA to spread everywhere, guess what you're going to have to be using, which is vancomycin. Next slide. Cost of VRE bacteremia, significantly higher, as shown in these two studies. Go to another slide where it says Salgado at the bottom, and you can see this is another meta-analysis. This one's focusing on VRE. They're concluding that there are higher rates of recurrence, higher case fatality rates, and higher mortality due to the bacteremia per se. Next slide. These, within that same meta-analysis, are looking at studies in which patients are matched for severity of illness. Each one concludes there's significantly higher mortality with VRE. Next slide. And then there are 10 multivariate analyses with enterococcal bacteremia and death, and looking at whether vancomycin resistance matters. The three with the smallest sample sizes and the lowest statistical power at the top, they found no risk. The three in the middle were middle-sized, and they found elevated risk of with odds ratios of 2 to 3, but they weren't statistically significant, but they had very wide confidence intervals, suggesting a lack of statistical power. And the four at the bottom were the biggest with the most statistical power, and they all found odds ratios of 2 to 3, and they were statistically significant and suggested that it does matter. Next slide. This is another meta-analysis just presented at ICAC this fall, which found, again, significantly higher death rates and significantly higher costs with VRE. Next slide. We should now be on one that says transfer of vancomycin resistance from VRE to Staph aureus. And you know that this was documented a decade ago and that we were expecting this to happen, and now we've seen two isolates of, frankly, vancomycin-resistant Staph aureus in the United States, and they were both reported in MMWR. Next slide. You should be on a slide that says studies showing cost-benefit of active surveillance cultures and contact precautions for controlling MRSA and VRE. And there's a bunch of them. Next slide. This study shows a list of all the studies I've been able to find that have shown no cost benefit of using this approach for controlling MRSA and VRE. And you'll notice that there are none. And yet many facilities don't take this approach because they assume that it will be more costly. And I would have to ask, if you're using an evidence-based approach, what evidence do you use when you don't use all of the published studies? Next slide. This comes back to that graph that I showed you before, and I already told you that if you take the difference in the frequencies and you multiply it times the published estimates of attributable cost for MRSA and VRE bloodstream infections, you come to differences of $1 to $3 million extra dollars per year, which is far more than the cost of doing cultures and isolation at our hospital during that year. Next slide. This is a study from Duke University which looked at the question of putting patients in the ICU directly into contact precautions, doing cultures, and if they were negative, then letting them come out of the isolation. And they concluded that MRSA went down, as you can see there, and the gown usage went down significantly, which was paradoxical. They thought since they were automatically putting everybody into isolation, that would go up. But in fact, as they controlled MRSA, they had less need to use isolation. Next slide. So we come now to the end of our hour together, and you can see the graph again from NIST showing MRSA doubling. Next slide shows the graph from Denmark showing control of MRSA. And now I hope that you recognize and agree with me that this increase in our country, in the United States, is occurring in a way by choice rather than by chance. We're choosing not to take the approach that these people in Northern Europe are taking that works. Next slide. The top line there is showing the number of deaths from antibiotic-resistant infections. The first number in there is 13,300. It was estimated by the CDC in 1992 in U.S. hospitals. And each year we've seen the rate of the infections goes higher, and I have to conclude that the death rate's going higher each year. At the bottom, you can see the deaths due to TB are there. And they're low and going lower every year. And I just want to make the point, with tuberculosis, we use appropriate transmission-based precautions. And we're controlling that. And we're not generating more. Whereas with the antibiotic-resistant infections, we are generally taking a don't-ask, don't-tell approach to the epidemics of colonization, which is driving the epidemic of infections. Next slide. And which leaves us with that graph from Denmark, and it leaves us with the question. I thank you for your attention. I'll be happy to try to answer any questions that you have.
On slide number 58, you talked about cleaning, the spray and wipe versus the bucket. I believe it was for MRSA. What was in the bucket? What was in the bottle?
It was for VRE, not MRSA. And what was in the bucket and in the bottle was a quaternary ammonium compound, and they were using that. It had already been shown to work. We knew it would kill the stuff if you soaked VRE in it. But they were using such a, you know, they were doing a light spray of a cloth and a jiffy wipe, which, as I guess, gave sort of a thin film of disinfectant. And some have postulated maybe they even missed some spots because they can't see where they've been after they put a thin film on something.
Do you endorse the use of bleach?
For killing, I don't think you have to go all the way to bleach. I'm not saying you can't use bleach, and bleach may be cost effective in many places, but quats are probably slightly more cost effective, and they are adequate to do the job as long as you do it right. And in fact, two other healthcare facilities that reported, one in Texas, University of Texas at Galveston, and the University of Nebraska, have similar reports where when they did environmental cleaning, unless they increased the rigor with which their environmental service people were doing it, they weren't getting adequate cleaning and reliable removal of VRE from those surfaces.
So what you use is not so important as how you use it.
That may be. It may be elbow grease, and the volume may be the volume of what you put there. So I said you wet it rather than putting a thin film that you can barely see.
I have a question in regards to portable phones in the rooms, equipment portable such as ECGs, et cetera. How do you prevent the spread, or do you recommend not bringing these into the rooms, et cetera?
You're talking about an ECG?
ECGs, portable phones.
And portable equipment.
Yeah, I mean, portable, it's been shown over and over again that fomites are fomites. And if they're things that we touch, we can put things on them, whether they're our ink pen, whether a pager, a stethoscope, an otoscope, an ECG machine, a computer, computers that are in the ICUs, or out in the nursing station can be contaminated with these things. If our hands are contaminated and we touch things, we put them on there. Interestingly, in that study that I showed you by Byers, where we were talking about disinfection and whether the bugs were still on the surfaces, we showed that the bugs were on surfaces all over the room, even in rooms where a patient was bedridden and couldn't get out of the bed. And these are bugs that don't move through the air. So the point is, healthcare workers are picking them up and moving them all over the place.
In the active surveillance recommendations, do you include the long-term care beds or geriatric beds that are actually situated in an acute care hospital?
Only if you want to control the problem.
That's a very direct answer. Thank you.
Can you define what active surveillance means?
Active surveillance means going out of your way with a swab towards somebody's nose or their bottom and or ulcers and swabbing them, looking for MRSA and or VRE. Let me just say in response to the previous questioner that for the long-term care, it is more controversial because they have less resources and many of their patients are demented. And so the question is, how can you control herds of people that are demented? But I'll just point out that there are multiple examples of doing this. That example that I showed you from the Siouxland Health District where they control VRE in 28 nursing homes, there's a publication in the Journal of the American Geriatric Society by Silverblatt et al. From several years ago, controlling VRE. There's a publication from Canada from, I forget if it was Andy Seymour or Allison McGeer, is one of those up there that was involved, I believe, where they were controlling antibiotic-resistant pathogens in a nursing home setting. There are other ones from Europe, from no one by Kotalainen from Finland. So it can be controlled. If we were going to go after this, if we were going to really go proactively in all the healthcare facilities, all the hospitals, we just remember, like in the state of Virginia, there's twice as many beds in nursing homes as there are in hospitals, and they're filled with people who are very high prevalence for antibiotic resistance, and they recycle through hospitals continually. So if we're going to take a proactive approach and control this, then I would suggest that we not forget that those pathogens are there and we need to be doing something, and there are multiple examples of doing it. And they include examples of doing it in a way that they limit the physical spread without preventing the patients from being able to socialize.
Can I just clarify my question about active surveillance? Are you doing weekly on admission, every 2 days, and do you isolate them while you wait for the results?
The answer is a variety of approaches have been used. There's a guideline
very quickly.
There's a guideline that has been developed by the Shea Task Force, which talks about this in detail, which should be published soon, and talks about using a variety of approaches, which includes culturing on admission and afterwards because of people who are high risk, because of antibiotics, location, et cetera.
Barry, thank you so much for this presentation. Sometimes in the teleclasses, I get to say, wow, and this is one of those. It's been very, very helpful. Thank you. Folks, we have reached the end of our time together. Thank you again for joining us, and thank you, Dr. Farr, for a fantastic presentation.
Thank you for having me.
Until next time, stay healthy. Bye-bye.